From La Negra y Blanca, Fugue and Commentary, a novel by Dina Metzger. 1492 began a history of torture in Europe and in the Americas. Victor named it the Unfinished Conquest. He didn't escape it. He probably always knew he would be its victim. He watched it come at him from all sides. If he had a prayer, it might have been that his writing would be sufficiently successful to cast him as one of the final victims. We did not know or understand what he knew. It seemed to us that there was a great divide between his work in Guatemala and his connection with his past and his Sephardic roots. What he had been trying to tell us was that they were the same. The conquest had merely cut down another pear tree, but this time in Guatemala. When he died, we didn't understand that he had become just another victim of an unending conquest. What was acknowledged was that anxiety, political anxiety, can raise blood pressure, and as he hated his meds and often refused them, he had fallen victim to his own recalcitrance. But when people asked, "How is your blood pressure?" "You," Victor would answer, "Riesmont," with the name of the dictator. Noncompliant is a term suited to blaming victims. Victims are blamed for the sufferings others contend they should have been able to avoid or overcome. We called his torture a stroke, and afterwards many of his friends chastised him for the delusion that he could control his blood pressure with his mind, or for preferring his mind as he knew it, for being resistant, for not recognizing medical authority, for being unwilling to endure side effects, for being naive and choosing inadequate and untested natural remedies, for being stubborn, for taking unnecessary risks, for choosing his way of suffering and its consequences in lieu of the medically prescribed way of suffering, side effects, and their consequences. His friends had predicated their lives on the belief that they could define and choose their destiny, that they had the right, that they could and should outwit death at a young age, that death at the height of one's vitality might be a sign of an inner failing. Victor had betrayed them. Perhaps the projection of our own concerns for our own lives, being marooned in the defining territory of our own anxieties, allowed us to miss the threat that was coming toward him. Such threats didn't exist in our lives. They belonged to other lives and other countries. We read about them. We were responsible citizens. We watched the news. We watched serious movies on such subjects, and our conversation consisted of praising those who dared to document violence and injustice. The privilege of an expanding universe, ease, license, advantage, power, created the ever-increasing space between ourselves and our fears, between ourselves and danger to us. Then our universe reached its zenith, or its nadir, choose as you will, and began contracting. We were living closer, increasingly, to what we feared, but we didn't know it yet. Blue, an expanding universe, had turned to red, contraction. We were colorblind to that transformation. Those who may have known something of the crisis firsthand buried alarm the way one buries toxic waste. If someone other than Victor testified, issued warnings, we responded as one does to literature. Another country we can enter, but also leave at will. Close the book. I say we. I didn't want to look away. and I didn't know I was looking away. We don't know what injured Victor. Medical diagnosis can't reconstitute his life. Maybe it was a direct physical attack by unidentified men on a lone man swimming in the lake at the end of the day when darkening sky and shadows merge so that all things, beings, actions, motives can be hidden. Or maybe it was brujeria, an invisible attack launched by the current agents of the conquest, or launched 500 years ago and still traveling. What was the truth of his affliction and death? He could never say, because his speech was taken from him. He couldn't speak of it, having spent his lifetime seeking it out. 20 years earlier, a dream had taught me that gaining information, the alleged purpose of torture, is actually a means of silencing a population. Of course, Victor had helped me understand the dream and the reality it described. We both hoped we would never yield to being silenced, though we didn't pretend we could possibly know what it was like to be dismembered, one limb at a time, or thrown into a pit, or forced into a latrine with rats while the guards laughed at our confinement, at our inability to escape, at our bellowing and useless crying out. When he was found by the lake the next day, he was lying face down, unconscious, on the small stretch of sand alongside the lakeshore. He had no papers on him. Only days later was he finally identified. When the police were able to match the seemingly abandoned locked car in the parking lot to the unknown man in the hospital. The doctors were certain that he would never speak and never walk again. Massive stroke, they said. They did not believe he would survive, and no one suspected that violence had been done to him. The causes they were seeking were physical and personal, such that could be directly related to conventional treatment, as if the ultimate causes were unrelated to his prognosis and so were best categorized as acts of God. This is the kind of understanding that sits best with unbelievers. But Victor had learned about gods in the guardhouse, drinking balche with Chunk'in, the Lacandon elder whose story he told in The Last Lords of Palenque. He knew the gods do not protect us from suffering, as it seems the gods had not been able or authorized or unwilling or without desire to save the Lacandon or the esteemed Chunk'in, even the great mahogany trees or the milpa, unless we. Even so, Victor also knew the gods do not authorize the violence attributed to them by so many of their alleged followers. I want to sit down again with the physicians who were attending Victor and were drawn ineluctably into the circle of concern that surrounded him and our determination that he would live, that he would walk, that he would speak. We got 2 out of 3. It was not enough. What we got was the exquisite ongoing torture. We got the pit. We got the equivalent of his tongue cut out. In retrospect, not anything we could characterize as victory or healing. I want to sit down with the physicians and ask them to backtrack and begin again. I want to say, you didn't have the diagnosis right. The direct cause of his affliction was the conquest. Now, what treatments will you prescribe? How can you call yourself a physician if you don't have a protocol for the conquest? Secretly, some of us have speculated that another aspect altogether of the story of the conquest had been activated and was implicated in Victor's suffering. If that was the case, then how was that segment of the story to be met? What amends were he and his party called to make, and to whom were they made? What has been left to us that we are barred from knowing truly what had occurred? Was Victor's illness only a failure to drown? Victor had been guiding a small group through the mythic landscape of the Lac Andon. They had visited Chunkeen, had stood alongside some of the remaining few standing mahogany trees, had gone down the Usumacinta River, bearing witness to the threat to dam it, and were stopping at Chichen Itza, the great Maya ruins. The teenage boy in their party wanted to swim in the cenote, in the deep turquoise and lapis pool of clear water that formed when the hidden calcium bones of earth dissolved and collapsed, leaving underwater caves to shelter the dead maidens sacrificed for the sake of war and to feed the hungry sun. Against all warnings and restraints, the boy found an opportunity to escape the eyes of the adults, raced to the cenote, and dove into the water. How could he expect an undertow in such a pool that looked to be absolutely still water? They say he dove and surfaced, swam towards the edge, began faltering, and then sank, slowly, disbelieving, one hand, reaching up, grasping air, disappearing as invisible hands pulled him down. Or he escaped his friends altogether, and no one saw him dive. Or they felt the undertow even before he reached the water and had held on to him as best as they could against forces they couldn't possibly understand, forces that had been set in motion in 1492, against which, not having identified the cause and taken action against it, not having made amends, they were helpless. They searched the waters as best they could. They never found him. The local police and army officials hesitated before the prohibitions of the dead. They would not themselves go into the water. They said, "The cenote is bottomless." Was it the maidens calling the boy down to them? Or was it all the warriors, hundreds, thousands, that the Spaniards speared and threw into the waters that were waiting for their revenge, waiting to enact a common fate on those who consider peering into these depths or deaths? Or was it the pull of the Spanish soldiers who also went down with the Maya and were looking to place their heels on someone's shoulder so they could boost themselves back into life? Was it revenge upon those who do their sightseeing at grave sites and charnel grounds? It could have been something simple, a gold cross on a thin gold chain around the young man's neck, a gold school ring, a gold bracelet. It is said that the Spaniards lusted so strongly for gold that once they saw it, they wanted to drink it. They wanted to eat it. It became their holy communion, and no one, no thing, would stand in their way of making it their own. In order for the dead to become ancestors and to serve the living, they have to do one thing. They have to admit their mistakes. When they do this, the doors open for the rains to come. The living cannot thrive without the assistance of the dead. The work of the dead is to become worthy or capable of serving. What Blanca knew about the important writer who was not Victor, but Morena's father and La Negra's lover, was not anything that the writer would ever have told Blanca, but nevertheless, what she knew was true. She knew it from the long look back after death, when he was no longer concerned with how he would be remembered, but with how he was required to remember himself. Mario Monteforte Toledo had been born into a prominent family that had always assumed its part in history, so his life was devoted equally to change and continuity, sustaining by custom and routine what he was equally committed to undoing. He took the life given to him without hesitation. The coat suited him, and you could see it in his stride, as he was fit and muscular in addition to being unusually sharp, observant, and intelligent. Eyes of the falcon. He walked confidently in the city, talking, as if he belonged to it, or on the land, as if it belonged to him, in contrast to those who, belonging to the land, walk quietly because they are listening. When he was alive, he did not question hope and desire or the authorization to act upon them. He had a legacy to fulfill. Destiny was his birthright. Now that the writer was dead, and because he had been a man who valued consciousness, he was required to examine his life from a different perspective. Blanca was not certain that she and he were in agreement about anything, but she knew things, and perhaps he recognized them as well. She knew that the important writer had made three mistakes. Each of them was grave. She knew the order in which he made them. Blanca knew that Mario Monteforte Toledo had enticed into his bed the young, brown, and sweet-breasted, dove-tongued bird woman, the one they called La Nena Vida. But he had not had the heart to stay and partner with her. A forceful ladino, a fire in the woods, a volcano erupting, such as he had been in his youth and remained unto his death. He was one who could wreak havoc upon an indigenous woman as easily as upon a woman from the city. Though he ultimately became the important writer, he didn't invent this narrative of domination and flight. Learning such gallantry from so many before him, especially those he also recognized as his adversaries, those who had taken arms against him in the past and in the present, he virtually kidnapped the woman's soul and then took off valorizing the flight in his fiction as well as in his life. Blanca knew that afterwards Monteforte Toledo had incited or allowed his mother to kidnap his infant daughter Morena from her mother, La Nena Vida, who would become Doña Vida through her loss. Ma Mère, his mother, took the coffee-colored, coffee-scented child from La Selva to the big city to be scrubbed clean of the aroma of decaying leaves, tobacco, incense, cacao, and berries. Blanca knew that Mario Monteforte Toledo had kidnapped 5 Lacandon Indians to exhibit within a fenced compound at the Feria Nacional de Guatemala in November 1938, as if they were the elements of an exotic botanical garden that were passing like the chinampas of Xochimilco into oblivion. Blanca knew this because Victor, a member of this Council of the Dead, witnessed this, wrote about it, and told her about it. But it hadn't been a secret. Mario Monteforte Toledo had also spoken and written about it without shame. Morena, the daughter, would find it easy to admit her first mistake. As soon as she was old enough to fly, she should have set out for Lake Atitlan to live with her mother, navigating like birds do by temperature, sight, scent, water, and desire. Had she done that, she would not have so many mistakes to admit now. No, not to admit, but to regret. Ah, morena querida, what little bird are you? What lost, soft, brown songbird did you become? What became of your home, my little one? And what became of your terrain? What little warbler, little thrush, nightingale, was captured and raised against its nature in a cage, singing its heart out far from the lake that is said by all to be the most beautiful in the world? My dear, lost, sad, brown bird, what would your father say here?
He would say,
I saved your life. If you had remained, you would have been killed by one side or the other during the 36 years of the siege. My daughter, the daughter of an indígena, would never have been left alive. I gave you life, and I saved your life. The important writer stole lives, and he saved lives.